This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Thursday, 10th of June, 2021. Equity market seems to be trying to get about as boring as it can get lately, although there's a little bit more, I think, to take away from what's going on. And before we actually talk about that, I just want to remind folks, if I've tweeted it out yesterday, I wish I put it in the podcast yesterday, just to flag that I'm doing an FX webinar later today. You can see the particulars on slide two. You can sign up for that on webinars.saxo. So if FX is your thing, have a look at that. And the recording, if you're unable to make it, will be available lower down on the same page, that webinars.saxo page, about a day after we do it. So sometime tomorrow. Getting back to what's maybe not going on in equities, could be a little bit more interesting than what is going on, given the tight ranges, Peter. I just find it a little bit interesting. We've had quite a slide here in these treasury yields. We're supposed to have a NASDAQ 100 that's very sensitive to yield developments. We've had very tight correlations in the NASDAQ 100 versus the treasury future. I pull up this chart once again on slide three. And we've seen quite an additional rally here last couple of sessions in treasuries. And NASDAQ 100 is flatlining. So at least it's not finding additional support or interest in that. I find it kind of interesting, but I don't know if that's, should be my takeaway here. Anything else you're noticing in this market right here?
No, I think you're pointing it out correctly, what's going on. I mean, although I will say that the NASDAQ really have jumped higher since the 4th of June, when you basically had the breakdown of the US 10-year yield. So I think it is responding. It's just taking a pause right now. I don't think the equity market is, I think the equity market is more split in terms of whether you have the transitory or the, you know, the more permanent inflationary pressures, whereas the bond market definitely has moved in much more in the transitory camp lately, it seems. But otherwise, I mean, if you look at equities, as you say, it's pretty boring. All the equity pockets were down yesterday, except for crypto and a biotech or next generation medicine basket, which is still seeing some sentiment being lifted from the Biogen FDA approval of their Alzheimer's therapy. European equities, flatlining over the 3 days. I still think that underlying momentum is strong. The crypto basket was up 5%. It was it has bounced really back quite significantly. The Bitcoin price from 32,000 level. There was a big news coming out on the Financial Times. Apparently, it was a big shock to a lot of traders in the commercial paper market that Tether, the stable coin, the biggest stable coin, which is under, you know, a lot of scrutiny from the controller in New York. They're looking into Tether, you know, how it's backed, and they have trouble finding any banks to really, you know, deposit cash. So they can't back it with cash. So they're going into the commercial paper market to the tune of Tether now being the seventh largest holder of commercial paper in the world, bigger than Apple and Google. And it's taking a lot of traders by surprise, according to this article. So there's two things from this. So first of it means that actually the stablecoin from Tether has some counterpart risk tied to credit risk in the commercial paper market. But also, if there's a crackdown on the overall crypto industry, it could have some wide ramifications for the commercial paper market, which is the liquidity and is really, you know, the oil that inside the cogwheels of the corporate sector in the US. So I think this is quite a disturbing, but also quite fascinating what's happening.
To say the least, that's a very interesting story there for sure. But and then on your comment on transitory, and then I'll switch over to the treasury market again here. We actually spent a lot of time yesterday pondering whether, you know, any signals we're getting from the treasury market here are reliable at all. There are signs that some people that are dealing with all this liquidity, and namely banks, are actually willing to go a little bit further out the curve just to pick up some yield, versus only buying the very short end where you're getting no yield pickup. So it's this huge question we have, at least until August 1st, when we finish this treasury account wind down at the Fed. Is there even any price discovery in treasuries here? What's your take, I'll say? I mean, I think for the cycle, you've been generally bearish on U.S. treasuries, but we're dealing with a rally that, you know, could be explained in a number of different ways here. What's your explanation and what do you think is going on?
Well, John, I think that at this point is more of a technical explanation. We have seen some short sellers unwinding their positions following the non-farm payrolls last week. And probably the rally that we've seen in US Treasury yesterday was triggered partly by that. But it's very hard now to understand how the bond market, why the bond yields are falling just before the CPI numbers. So that's something that I really struggle to understand. But, you know, just to give some sort of idea where yields can go, on slide number 5, I put a chart which looks at 10 years yields. And now, just before I came here, they broke below the 100-day simple moving average. And so they will find the support next at 1.4%. If they break below this level, they can fall as much as 1.2. However, my long-term view for US Treasuries is to resume their rise. And the question here is when the CPI numbers could be like an event if they really surprise on the upside. But I think that at this point in time, we might need some bond vigilantes, right? Straightening up this direction.
Yeah, and we also had a strong auction yesterday, and there's a 30-year today. It looks like that would likely be strong as well. But it's very interesting. It's coming after the CPI number.
Yeah, exactly. So the 30 years can be actually quite volatile.
All right. So we're to talk a little bit about inflation here, and maybe to skip around just a tad and on that CPI data print, I got some perspective on the core CPI in black. If you go to slide 9, this is the core year on year. So it you know, got rounded to 3% flat in the April cycle. That was the highest since the early 1990s. And we're looking at the underlying inflation, so-called beta series here, in orange, which has not quite even reached the highest of 2018. I suspect there's some housing components there, just judging from where it's looking at, where it's, you know, fallen and risen to compared to the previous cycles in 2008 and 2018. But Peter, you and I had a brief exchange about whether we're heating up like the 1970s. What's your point here on slide 6?
Well, you said basically that we won't get something like the 1970s growth. That would be impossible, quote. I think you're right in the sense that if you look at the slide 6 to the and the chart to the right, that's the one I've done, and the one to the left is from Deutsche Bank. But if you take our own slide on the right, we have data points from US fiscal deficits and percentage of nominal GDP, and you have the output gap on the y-axis. So that's all your data points since 1970. And it's correct. So in the 70s, you had very high positive output gaps in the other, meaning that the economy was running far above its potential, which typically is associated with inflationary pressures. It did so without a massive fiscal deficits. That's what your data points there are showing you. So it was a different type of growth in the 70s than the one I'm proposing here. So, but what I'm saying is that in a couple of quarters, as Deutsche is saying as well, we will be running at pretty significant output gap surplus, meaning that the economy is running very hot, and we'll do that at the same time of a very significant fiscal deficit. And that brings us to the discussion you and I had at the desk yesterday, John, because, you know, if the Biden administration is not extending all these different programs that have been put in place during the pandemic, technically that could in itself cause a recession within the next 12 to 18 months. So I think there's just so much incentive for the U.S. government to keep the cylinders pumping, and they do so by keeping all these programs in place, and that means that you'll have a U.S. economy that will stimulate like we have never seen before. That's basically what the chart is showing. And if you look at Deutsche's chart as well, they have a baseline case, but they also have a higher case scenario, and that is actually the output gap would go to plus almost 6%. I mean, that would just be absolutely outrageous. It's not something we have seen since the 60s in the US.
Yeah, and then on that note, I mean, you're right. I think if you run through the numbers, people have pointed out, you actually have a recession baked into the cake for next year if you don't extend and even grow some of these numbers, unless there's a massive move out of savings. So people drawing down savings and really running out and spending. So it's a very interesting setup we have. And there's been a bit of disappointment here in the recent part of the cycle with the, you know, questioning whether any kind of stimulus deal is going to get done. And it's very small. It's just peanuts, really, on the infrastructure side. If you look at the rate of spending on that per year relative to these stimmy checks, et cetera. Ola, I imagine you're getting a bit impatient here because you've been standing patiently by. But if we look at, and we can actually make a segue here, as you're pointing out, gesturing frantically, inflation expectations. And we've talked about this as well yesterday, that even though we've seen a fall in nominal yields, generally the inflation expectations have been falling as fast or even faster if you look on a sort of moving average basis. What's gold thinking here? Because it would seem like we would get, with the falling nominal yields, you would have thought gold would have rallied even better in recent days.
Exactly. There was a lot of head scratching yesterday because gold did move higher as yields, nominal yields moved lower, but not to any kind of accelerating extent at all. We briefly just kissed almost 1900 once again before drifting lower, and we're trading lower today again. And I think you just have to look on the right-hand side here on slide 11, basically looking at nominal yields is one thing, but you need to go underneath the hood just to see what's happening in the engine. And in the engine, you saw break-even yields coming down, i.e. inflation expectations coming down, as Atea said, just ahead of a potentially big CPI print, but well, that's the market's interpretation. At the same time, real yields, which is really the key driver for gold, stayed pretty flat on the day and actually closed on the high on the day. So that's the reason why gold was not responding. And it also means that, as we talked about recently, that some of this long-term trend following shorts that has been in the gold market, they have now been removed. And that basically means going forward from here, in order to break higher, we need to see macroeconomic data come to the support. And that really means real yields needs to come down or dollar needs to come down.
All right. And one of the key inflationary drivers, of course, certainly in the 70s, as we talked about before, but also in the last time we had a quite proper inflationary episode in 2005, 6, 7, and 8 was oil prices. Saw a new high for the cycle yesterday, but it just struggled for air and just kind of come back down. What's going to be the next sort of directional driver there?
Well, I think it is still the question of whether we can get this synchronized global growth and fuel demand back on track. We can get some of these vaccines starting to have an impact on places in Asia like India, which looks like it's starting to improve. But what we saw yesterday was the rally above $70 proved to be a little bit short-lived here in the first instance, at least. And that was after the EIA weekly stock report showed that even though we saw crude oil stockpiles drop for a third consecutive week, we saw quite a big jump, as you can see on slide 10, in both distillates. So that's diesel and gasoline stocks. So, and that's because refineries at this time of year, they're just revving up dramatically to produce a lot of fuel ahead of the driving season. So what's really key for these numbers is that the U.S. motorist actually responds. And yesterday, the four-week average for motor gas implied demand was actually ticking down a little bit. So that probably also just added to some of the unease in the market. But generally, I think it's more just the market pausing and just a little bit of profit-taking after failing to hold on to 70.
All right. Now, we have a couple of the big event risks today. We have mentioned the CPI data out of the U.S. prominently. We also have an ECB meeting. To my mind, the expectations around it are not particularly high here, but I think it comes at an interesting time, I'll say, because we saw this interesting pump in European yields, especially bunds breaking above those big levels. I'm forgetting all the levels now, 0.2% negative. It broke above that. And even the negative 15 basis points I'm seeing on your chart here on slide 7. But we've really kind of, we've seen a pretty strong rally in Europe and core Europe, and even the big Italian BTP auction. We talked about that yesterday, massively oversubscribed. Are we going to get much from the ECB meeting that moves yields here?
Well, I think that the ECB meeting is going to strengthen bullish sentiments in European sovereigns, because our expectation is for the ECB to keep monetary policy unchanged. and also not to discuss any type of tapering. You see, we are entering in summer, and in summer, the primary market is going to slow down. So naturally, also purchases under their various programs are going to slow down. So it doesn't really make sense for them like to start to discuss about tapering now. However, if we go on slide 7, I put on the left a chart showing a Bund 10-year yields. And the big comment here is that if the ECB maintains sounds dovish, then it could put further pressure on 10-year bond yields. And just as I was coming here, they were trading at minus 0.25, which is a weak support level. And basically here, they could even fall fast to minus 0.40%. However, I think that also in the European sovereign space, it's very important to monitor the CPI numbers, because if there is a surprise and US Treasury yields resume their rise, then we can expect the same in Europe. Just very quickly, yesterday we have discussed in other podcasts about the weak performance of Bund options lately. And yesterday, when yields were falling in Europe, Germany issued a 30-year Bunds, zero coupon. And the thing is that it went fairly well. However, the lowest accepted bid that was around 91.25%, which is the lowest since January last year and the second lowest in 10 years. So basically means that investors remain suspicious about duration.
Suspicious about duration. And interesting as well for the ECB, I noted yesterday they're planning some kind of retreat, quote unquote. This would be in lieu of the Centra conference, which was canceled. It would normally be taking place this month. Their big policy review, sort of like the Fed's Jackson Hole. They're doing a retreat instead, June 18th to 20th. And they are actually going through with Centra, but at a much later date of November. So I think that November date, not coincidentally, about a month after the German election, I think that's where the ECB is really putting its heads together to figure out what any major policy overhaul they'll be doing, if any, around that time frame. All right, now as we go, there's one more story that I want to get back to you with, Peter, but just to round off the CPI and the reaction. I think if we're looking to the upside, I mean, we're expecting the highest core readings in essentially decades here. And yet treasuries are bid, the dollar is flat. It feels like it's going to take an awful lot to surprise this market on an upside print, an upside surprise in the CPI. So maybe the interesting scenario surprise-wise would be a downside surprise and a fairly large one, in which case I think it'd be interesting a test in FX or something like the Japanese yen, which to me already looks a little bit weaker than it should be given where yields are going. I've got a chart there on slide 8, or just pull up your dolly yen chart. We had that reversal and rejection of 110. Interesting there. Interesting in the yen crosses as well on a downside surprise. I'm not calling a downside surprise. I'm just saying maybe that's the more interesting scenario. And then another, I mean, we're all over the place, but there's an awful lot going on, I think, subsurface, even though a lot of these markets are not so volatile here. An interesting story, Peter, we've talked about this before. It's so unusual to have this whole setup in the U.S. of this pay for order flow. So basically, end customers in these popular apps think that they're trading, quote unquote, for free, when actually their order flow is being sold, and the prices they get are being manipulated by market makers in the market makers' favor, and they're actually paying something for the spread and the execution. But take us through this development, the news from the SEC, and what the reaction here is in the market.
Yeah, so I think the payment for order flow has been around for many, many years in the US, and never seen as a huge problem, but it surfaced to the attention of regulators and the SEC during the GameStop squeeze. Probably our listeners can remember that the Congresswoman AOC, she also had this live discussion with some people in the industry, if I remember correctly, and she sort of took it to the political circles, and now the GameStop sort of disappeared a little bit, and then it has resurfaced, this whole meme stock phenomenon. It's getting more and more crazy almost day by day. And Robinhood is very much in the scope here. So the SEC chairman, Gensler, is saying that they're going to review the rules. And this is, Virtue was taking a hit of 8%, as you can see here on slide 12. But Virtue is not the biggest beneficiary of payment for order flows. That's by far Robinhood. I should actually have put in a chart on that, but I've put in two other charts, so you can see that this is an old data, but it's probably been a little bit worse. You could say the payment for order flow was 70% of Robinhood's Q1 2020 revenue breakdown. I would probably put it at 90%, given where we are right now on their trading volume. And you can actually see the development. So one of the key things that have been discussed by the SEC, but also Gensler, he's pointed out. So if you look at the payment for order flows last year, the options on the chart to the left, so that's the light blue there, a light blue greenish color. And this is one of the points. So when you have payment for order flow, the SEC is saying that it incentivizes Robinhood to create a lot of trading, because the more trading you get, so you make stock trading for free, options trading for free, and you sell the order flow to Citadel Securities or Virtue or whatever, and that it basically just incentivizes you, that you create an app and an ecosystem that actually makes people addicted and just trade as much as possible, because then you get as much payment for order flow as possible. Whereas if you had a basic commission structure, the customers will be seeing upfront their cost and their friction of trading all the time, and it would significantly reduce the speculation. So I think we're moving forward with some changes to the payment for order flow. I don't think it's going away entirely, judging from the CEOs of the different market makers commenting yesterday on Twitter. But let's see. It's definitely this definitely jeopardizes the Robinhood IPO, I would say. It scares investors away.
Interesting stuff. Okay, now let's go to the macro calendar. An interesting day ahead, especially later in the day, of course, with the ECB meeting and then the press conference, and then the May CPI. And just so you can jot down a couple of figures, 0.5 month-on-month expected for both. That's actually down from the 0.8 and 0.9, respectively, for the headline and core month-on-month readings in April. But the year-on-year expected to notch up to 4.7% on the headline and 3.5% on the ex-food and energy for this year-on-year US CPI data. So keep stay tuned for that. And then we have claims and the usual stuff as well. Again, as mentioned, a T-bond auction. Interesting to see that after the strength of the 10-year yesterday and post the CPI data release. Ola, we have your monthly oil market report from OPEC. Is that going to be is that highly anticipated in this market?
Probably not as much as the IEA's tomorrow, because we just had the OPEC meeting, OPEC Plus meeting a couple of weeks back, and basically OPEC put forward their estimates back then. So I don't think we're going to see any major change from there. So probably more looking ahead to the IEA's oil market report tomorrow.
All right. And then tomorrow, as mentioned yesterday, we have the Russian Central Bank rate announcement, where there's uncertainty on whether it's going to be 0.25% or 0.5%. And I lean towards 0.5% on the food price inflation angle there. And G7 meeting, watch out on the geopolitical front, because we have potential for a statement that produces language on the Taiwan Strait, Uyghurs in China, in the Xinjiang province of China, and COVID-19 origins, and China's response to any statement that includes these topics, I think will be very interesting as a setup going into next week and just going forward in general for the temperature of relations between China and Europe and the U.S. For today, that is a wrap. We'll be back tomorrow to see how things stand after this US CPI release and with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.